How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
Terms and conditions apply.
I mean, I've done this for 25 years. There has never been a term like this. This has been the strangest term. And a piece of that is that there's this one story, which is what's happened in the doctrine, right? What happened to the Chevron, you know, deference, what right. happened in the immunity case. And then there's this other strand that is the corruption scandals, the self-dealing, secret conclaves in California. And those are not different stories.
Hey, folks, welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. I'm Michael Steele.
Yep,
you can tell by the tan. I really appreciate you guys dropping in to this episode. We've got Dahlia Lithwick, who is a senior editor at Slate, and she's written their Supreme Court dispatches and jurisprudence columns since 1999. So this sister has been in the Supreme Court space for quite a while. She hosts Amicus, Slate's award-winning bi-weekly podcast about the law and the Supreme Court, which is a lot of fun to listen to. And she breaks stuff down very nicely. And she did this time. It's a great conversation. And she shares with us some insights, certainly from her book, Lady Justice, Women, the Law, and the Battle to Save America, as well as a number of the Supreme Court cases that have arisen in the last term that are vexing and perplexing. Dahlia Lithwick, right here on the Michael Steele podcast, coming up right after this.
Riley Herbst from 2311 Racing here. And you know what grinds my gears? Waiting for coffee. But instead of counting frappes and lattes, I fire up Chumba Casino. No apps, no fuss, just fun social casino games to pass the time. By the time my coffee's ready,
order for Riley.
I've already taken a few victory laps. Next time you're stuck waiting, make it entertaining. Play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. If you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. Choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, everybody. I'm so glad you could drop by the Michael Steele podcast. I'm excited to have Dahlia back because it has been way too long since the two of us have sat down and had a conversation about law and politics. And not much has happened since the last time we were together. Dahlia, welcome to the podcast. It's so great to have you come over from the Amicus because that's what you host, the Amicus podcast.
It's good to be with you, Michael. I was just thinking, so often we're on MSNBC and we're just like, our heads are on fire and we have like 4 minutes into which to contain that. So it's nice to have a little bit of time.
We have time. And I just, I love having you on because you, there's a small number of, I think, legal analysts, who are for either current or former practitioners who I think really have crystallized the environment that we find ourselves in as a country right now, whether it is dealing with the crazy of Eileen Cannon, the unnerving, retrogression of the Supreme Court into setting up an authoritarian president. Certainly what we see happening in other aspects of our judicial system and the way our system has largely bent backwards to accommodate the most infamous felon in the history of the country. Just give us your assessment of, as you've looked at these storylines unfold and follow them and talk about them on your podcast, how do you see it right now? And then we'll get into some of the specific stuff, and certainly we'll go to the naughty playground of politics. but I'm just very curious your top line view of where we are and how we got here.
I think I have two top lines, and I think I want to be clear. I'm still metabolizing a Supreme Court term that, you know, was not. I mean, I've done this for 25 years. There has never been a term like this, and I think people don't understand that even though the last 2 weeks of June are typically bonkers, they're not bonkers in this way. And so this has been the strangest term. And a piece of that is, and I know this is one of the reasons I'm here, that there's this one story, which is what's happened in the doctrine, right? What happened to the Chevron, you know, deference, what happened in the immunity case, what happened in the EPA case. And then there's this other strand that is the corruption scandals, the self-dealing, the, you know, luxury RV and the fishing trips and the, you know, secret conclaves in California. And those are not different stories. I think the top line thing that I want to say is that we tend to sort of atomize each of the Supreme Court stories into two lanes. One is all the doctrine and one is all the corruption, and that those are two different stories. And I want to just really refocus on the fact that they're the same story, right?
Yes,
and this,
yes.
In some sense, you can't like have these episodic, like, that's appalling. Another trip that Clarence Thomas didn't disclose, right? Another loan he didn't disclose, and not see that the thing that was bought and paid for by a sort of 20, 30 year effort to purchase members of the Supreme Court totally came to fruition this year. Like every piece of what we saw this year was that ethics and corruption story playing out on the docket. And I think it's just really important to push those back together, because otherwise I think we only see half the story.
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent way to set it up, because it does really cause you to scratch your head about the idea of the reaction that a lot of people across the country have had to the ethics stories, the reaction of the court itself to this, and the idea that they wanted to compartmentalize and separate them and push them. Well, yeah, my getting a loan for $250,000 or having someone pay for a $250,000 Winnebago is not the same as ruling on a case that the person who gave me the loan is interested in. I mean, so there's this side and that side don't go together. But what you're talking about is, nah, baby girl and boy, let's put them together so you understand exactly what's happened to the court.
Even more so, I would say, because there's the corruption part, and then there's the, my wife was actively involved in the events of January 6th.
Yes.
My wife flew an upside down flag, or my wife flew, you know, this incredibly disturbing Christian nationalist, you know, appeal to heaven flag. But that has nothing to do with the doctrine either. And again, justices whose partners or intimate, you know, family members have skin in the game on January 6th, shouldn't be hearing January 6th cases. Justices who have now signaled approval of a kind of Christian nationalist worldview probably shouldn't be hearing the Mifepristone case, which is rooted completely in theological values. And so I think that we're both in agreement, but I just want to, you know, urge people, because I think this is my takeaway. The ethics conversation makes us feel powerless, right? We're like, well, what can you do? You know, the Supreme Court says there's that, you know, they can't be told what to do by Congress. And, you know, they have this hilarious clothing optional. Sometimes they enforce it against themselves. Sometimes they don't. Ethics rules that are not, you know, enforceable. And we feel powerless in the face of that. And what I want to say is that's not just like judges taking trips and tips. That is a bought and paid for enterprise that starts with a bunch of multimillionaires and billionaires who want deregulation, who want to see the oil and gas industry freed up from regulation, who want to see the EPA, you know, hobbled so they can't regulate. And they fish their wish there to this term. And if that makes you feel powerless, then we have to do something about
it. So then help contextualize some of this then, because what you get from folks on the right is the overreach of the government by the government, meaning laws passed, regulations imposed by the various agencies and departments, and the laws by the Congress. The Supreme Court is there to check the constitutional viability of those things. And when they do so and find that they're not constitutionally viable, why is everybody screaming that, you know, somehow we're partisan? How does that get addressed? Because there is this narrative of trying to, and again, it may go to your first point about keeping those things separated, go to the point of sort of separating through their eyes, their lens, the politics from the constitutional. And when in fact, what it looks like to a lot of us is the politics is overriding the constitutional. And that's where the concern comes in.
Right. And that is, I think, the nut of the question. And I think one of the themes of this term is the Supreme Court saying, you know, we can all agree that when the Justice Department investigates someone, you know, with the intent of filing an indictment, that's the deep state at work, right? And some of that language leaches into both Fisher, the January 6th case, it leaches into the presidential immunity case. Like, let's have grievous doubts about the deep state and how they're operating at the Justice Department. The deep state wants to impose all these unfair climate regulations.
Right.
You know, all of the pencil pushers at the EPA just want to say that, you know, downstream pollution is, you know, something we should deal with. But they're all not to be trusted. Right. The deep state. I mean, think about the through line. The deep state at the FDA said after extensive study, mifepristone is safe and effective. We're going to let it be on the market. But they're all lying because they love abortion. And so the through line through this entire term, and it's not just this term, is exactly in that key you just invoked, which is, but they're not to be trusted, right? Nobody in the government is to be trusted. Nobody in DOJ is to be trusted. The entire architecture of our regulatory world is full of sort of hollow-eyed, pencil-pushing bureaucrats who just want to take away our freedom. And that has been said for so long that it almost sounds like, maybe it's true. Maybe every single regulatory agency, all those ABC agencies that make sure that the water is clean and the food is safe and that the environment isn't full of toxins, maybe they're all a bunch of, you know, lying bureaucrats. Until you remember that the Chevron case, right, which is the motherlode case, and we can talk about it specifically, but it's essentially essentially the case in Loper Bright that does away with an idea that was from the 1980s, right, which is simply, the case was called Chevron, kind of aptly in hindsight, but it was a case from the 1980s that said that if a statute is ambiguously written, if a regulation is not clear, we're going to defer to the experts at the agencies to interpret it as they see fit. Why? Because they have all the scientific and deep sort of data-driven, fact-based knowledge, and we're just judges, right? And that was the rule for many decades, that if the EPA says, this is our interpretation of the Clean Air Act, this is our interpretation of the Clean Water Act, judges stay out of it. That was flipped this year in probably one of the most seminal cases that a lot of people missed. And the reason it's important, Michael, is that when that Chevron case came down, the people on the court who loved and supported it were the conservatives.
Right.
The conservatives were the ones who pushed Chevron. No one loved Chevron deference more than Antonin Scalia. And so it tells you how far we've moved, that we overturned a case that came up through the conservative legal movement to constrain judges from second-guessing agencies, and we flipped it completely on its head and said, judges, have at it. You know better about water pollution.
And what is the logic? What is the logic there? Because judges don't have access to the science. They don't have access to the data. And to the extent that they do, they don't have the staff nor the capacity to fully digest over an extended period of time the effect, impact, necessity or whatever of that particular issue in front of them, whether it is something like mifepristone or whether or not the pH levels in the water are at the appropriate level. What the hell does a judge know about pH levels in water? And why would they even care, except for in a case-specific matter in which you're going to have, guess what? Scientists and regulators and others giving testimony to that. And then they'll make a decision based off of that science and that and those regulations. But now it looks like what the Supreme Court has said is, judges, you are now the regulators.
And that's 100%.
You get to decide.
And if you think that's crazy, think back to mifepristone, right? Where Judge Matthew Kaczmarek in Amarillo, Texas, is like, I don't care what the FDA thinks. I don't care what all those scientists and studies, what every single other constitutional democracy that long ago, long before the US did, green-lighted mifepristone as a safe drug. I know better. And that's what exactly the move you just described. You have given every district court judge permission, and not just permission, but like constitutional authority to second guess any decision they don't like. And the reason for it, I think, is partly where you started your question, which is we have now got decades of attacks on regulatory agencies, right? This is the Grover Norquist. We're going to shrink government down till we can drown it in a bathtub. And I think that the punchline is, and everybody probably knows this, but in that EPA case, Justice Neil Gorsuch keeps talking about nitrous oxide, which is laughing gas, right?
Right.
And what he means is nitrogen oxide, but he gets that wrong in the opinion multiple times. He's regulating laughing gas. And it's sort of like on its own terms clear why judges should not be in the business.
Because he had no clue
things.
What he was talking about. He didn't know the difference.
No clue. And if you look at one of the cases that probably didn't get as much, no case got as much attention as it needed, but the bump stock case.
Yes.
Where Clarence Thomas says, you know, how dare the government regulate bump stocks? This is Donald Trump's decision after the Las Vegas shooting. So it's a Republican effort to say we're going to regulate bump stocks, which turn guns into machine guns. We're going to regulate them under the statute that controls machine guns. And here's Clarence Thomas affixing like photos and GIFs and like, you know, studies from the gun industry saying, no, I know better. I know better how guns operate. Let me show you. And so I think all of this goes to your point, Michael, which is so important, which is since the time of FDR, whether you like it or not, government has happened by way of regulatory agencies. And if we don't like them, and this is the kind of constitutional cherry on top, we vote them out, right? If you don't like what government is doing, if you don't like what the ATF is doing or what the CDC is doing, every 4 years you have a chance to say, you're out. I want someone else. What you cannot do, once a judge has told you that a bump stock is not a machine gun, there's nothing to be done. Doesn't matter who you vote for. Doesn't matter what laws you pass, right? Because the judge has the last word. And so it's not just the two moves that we're describing. One is arrogating fact-finding power and all of the sort of like scientific determinants to the judges who have no expertise in this. But the other move is actually taking it away from the elected branches who we can hold accountable. And those two moves together in the sort of deregulatory space are an absolutely chilling development that I'm not sure we paid enough attention to this time.
You wrote a piece just a few days ago a couple of days ago in Slate, on slate.com, entitled "Are We Finally Letting Go of Our Learned Helplessness Syndrome Around the Supreme Court?" What did you mean by that? What is the genesis of that question based off of what we learned out of this past session and of the Supreme Court?
I mean, part of it is exactly the issue we started with, which is, what do you do when you're finding out by way of ProPublica, right? By way of Politico, right, by way of the New Republic and the New York Times, that judges have taken, some of the justices have taken millions of dollars of undisclosed gifts, despite the fact that they are required by, you know, by law to disclose and to recuse. And what has been our response? Shrug, right? There's nothing to be done. The justices tell us that they have their own ethics requirements and they police themselves. And so that learned helplessness is very, very dangerous for democracy. The idea that they can do what they want, and anytime we criticize them, we're trying to delegitimize the court. And I know you've been accused of this too, that you can't criticize the court unless you want to have no court. And that's not in all right. appropriate. That's called shooting the messenger.
Right.
And then the other piece of that, that what triggered this specific piece, was last week President Biden suggesting, in lieu of, you know, this should have happened, you know, 10 years ago or 20 years ago, but suggesting finally, in light of the court term, we should think about term limits. We should think about ethics requirements. And the response that I saw was, well, we can't do anything. You know, we can't do anything without amending the Constitution. We can't do anything about any of this. We're just stuck. And what I wanted to suggest, and I said in the piece, is that every other constitutional democracy in the world has either age limits or term limits. Every other constitutional democracy in the world has ethics rules that are applied. We are the outlier in every single way when it comes to a Supreme Court that cannot be governed by anything, cannot be checked, and that does things like, oh, we don't care if the Voting Rights Act was, you know, reauthorized by huge margins. It's by 5-4, you know,
right,
everything is unconstitutional. Other countries have jurisdictional limits on courts. Other countries have ethics rules. Other countries say, you know, my amicus podcast this past weekend, I interviewed a justice on the Canadian Supreme Court, mandatory 75-year-old age, you step down. I mean, courts can be regulated, Michael, and
so
the
why
Supreme
do we,
Court can be regulated.
So why do we have this attitude, this approach of helplessness when it comes to this Supreme Court? And I think, you know, I'm listening to members of Congress during the flare-up of the ethics questions around Alito and Thomas, and they're like, well, there's nothing we can do. I was like, you control their budget. Zero out their budget. Oh, trust me, Chief Justice Roberts will come to Capitol Hill in a heartbeat and talk about anything you want to talk about. But what is that all about? Are we now in this space where we so elevated the Supreme Court over the, you know, first 235 years of our history? And now in the last 13 years of that history, as we are coming up on our 250th anniversary in 2 years as a nation, that the bloom is off that rose. We see it now for what it is, a human institution that needs to be regulated and have oversight and limitations placed on it. But we're now having to reconcile our awe of it with this reality. And so we're kind of stuck on stupid.
I love the idea of thinking about it through the lens of like awe and religion, because I think that's right. I think in a very strange way, this is the most secular country in the world that is, in a sense, most religious. And
yes,
the religion is the court. The court is built to look like a temple. The justices wear black robes. They say, we're not going to tell you what speeches we're giving or where, because we're sacred, right? We're not going to let you have cameras in here. The Canadian Supreme Court has been televised for decades. No cameras in the U.S. Supreme Court. We had to fight to get audio. So I think you're right. I think that there is a kind of Oracle of Delphi vibe that they have been burnishing for hundreds of years. And we are now completely enthralled to that. We're like, well, you know, I guess they are gods. And I just want to say one other thing, because I think it's really responsive to the very first framing question you asked me, which is, for a very long time, dummies like me would say, we don't want to push the court too far because they have so much power. They have granted themselves so much power. And we know that John Roberts has a kind of hand on the wheel. And we know that there's this moderate faction on the sort of 6-3 right. supermajority right wing. And so we're going to assume that they're in good faith when they say we believe in democracy. And I think people like me who really felt strongly, and this is, I think, the existential question I bring to this conversation, we're going to need this court in November when they decide the election. We're going to need this court. And so for us to kneecap the court is a profoundly dangerous move, right? We've seen what's happened in Poland and Hungary and other former democracies when the courts are captured. And so I think there has been a sense that the court was self-regulating. When the rubber hit the road, Michael, John Roberts was not on the... Exactly. So this term proved that I was a dummy and proved that those of us who really drank the Kool-Aid, that we don't have to think about restructuring this court because John Roberts is an institutionalist and he's like Rehnquist and he wants to be, you know, John Marshall. And at the end of the day, he's going to put the integrity and the public respect for the court above his own parochial interests. Wrong.
Right.
Wrong,
we got bamboozled on that. In fact, it goes to
6-3, 6-3, 6-3.
Right. It terms. Goes to the heart of the, you know, the, that's why for a number of years now, some of us have been looking at the process of elevating one to the Supreme Court, where they do the sort of roundabout on Capitol Hill and they sit down with the members in their offices and they have these conversations and the senator comes out and goes, oh, it was a very good conversation that we had today. And everybody, I think we have a good nominee here. And then they get in front of the country and they're having these hearings and they ask them, so... You are not going to impose your personal views on the rulings of the court. You're not going to, you know, push Roe versus Wade aside. You're gonna stand on precedent and stare decisis and all of this. And they're like, yes, sir, we will. We're gonna do. I believe that as a member of the court, that, you know, we should honor precedent. And we should honor and value the history of the court. And then this shit comes up like Chevron and Dobbs and voting rights. And they're like, strike it down, change it, knock it out. We're the imperial court. And you sit there and you ask yourself, not just how we get here, but the more important question is, how do we fix this? Since the court has basically said, like, you know, like MC Hammer, can't touch this, right? You can't touch this. No matter what, we can't touch this, right? And more importantly, you can't touch us. I'm going to take a quick break. And when I come back, I want to get into some of the solutions that the Biden administration was proposing and some of the ideas that I think, you know, that are, could be out there to sort of reshape this. And then we want to take a look at some of the cases that I know you've been following with a great deal of heartburn. we're having a lot of fun with my friend Dahlia Lithwick, host of Amicus, Slate's award-winning biweekly podcast about the law and the Supreme Court. We'll have more with Dahlia on the Michael Steele podcast right after this.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. So all you legal beagles out there, I hope you're engrossed in this conversation. And those of you who, you know, like the law is kind of over your head, just get a little extra something in the cup and follow along. You'll be fine. Don't worry, because Dahlia is breaking it down for you. Dahlia, so before we went to break, we were talking about how the Supreme Court is kind of a lot like MC Hammer, can't touch this. But there are ways in which efforts are coming together to touch the court. You talked about a little bit ago about, you know, term limits and things like that. There are proposals that the Biden administration are now looking to push out there that do go into some form of term limits, things like that. One that I know is very popular among more progressive members is an expansion of the court. Just for the record and people understanding, you can speak to this as well. The court has been expanded before. It's not a big deal. It's not something you got to go through a constitutional hoop to do. It can be done. How do you see this? What kind of recommendations, if you're made president of the day for the day, and your focus was on the Supreme Court, what would you be proposing, and how would you see it get implemented?
And I want to start by lifting up something that you said, which is really important, which is we have a tendency to think that it's always been this way, and it's not always been this way, right? There's nothing in the Constitution that says 9 seats. We've had 6 seats. We've had 11 seats. Historically, the size of the court was meant to be congruent with the number of circuit courts, right? Federal right. appeals courts, which means that, you know, 9 seats when there were 9 circuits, right? We can go up now. We can add seats to
how many circuits do we have now?
We have 13 circuits.
13, so 13 seats. Sure.
I think that what we forget is, and Heather Cox Richardson does such a nice job of this, when Supreme Court justices in the old timey days, they used to have to do something called ride circuit.
Yes.
Where they'd have to like get on a horse and like go out to the Third Circuit and sleep in a barn, often like sleep piled up in a bed with other people. Like, it was not what it is. And the Supreme Court has had its jurisdiction modified. It's had the number of seats modified. It's right. This is so we get this idea, and I just really want to emphasize something that you said, that we have this story that we tell that FDR tried to pack the courts, which is the sort of unfavorable terminology for adding seats to the courts. And he failed, right? And that's the story we tell. Almost jeopardized the most popular presidency in American history by trying to pack the courts. But the second half of the story is the important part, which is a whole bunch of justices stepped down and a whole bunch of justices changed their minds and stopped, right? Striking down all of his New Deal regulations and start being like, oh, this is a great regulation. So that's not a story about not adding seats. That's a story about if you like kind of bring a butter knife to a gunfight, you lose. If you look like you're really serious about adding seats, you get the famous switch in time that saves 9, right? Where justices start to behave in ways that are not throttling the New Deal legislations. I think the thing that I want to really lift up that you just said is that when Sam Alito tells the Wall Street Journal, you can't do anything to regulate the courts, Congress can't touch the courts, his actual seat was added to the court. Like, that is not an original seat. The seat that he sits in was a seat that was added when the court was expanded. So it's simply false to say Congress is, you know, in a hostage situation where they can do nothing. So then just to respond to your question, I think that I would really send people, and I want to push back on the idea that like this is, you know, wonky legal stuff, because I am a firm believer in the fact that everybody's allowed to have opinions about both doctrine and the cases and the court. Yeah. And I think we sideline ourselves and say like, oh, I don't have a fancy JD, so like I'm going to only let those people talk. And I think that, you know, at the founding, that was never the idea, that the court was made of magic and nobody could have opinions except lawyers. And so I want to get us back to every single person listening to this show is entitled to have an opinion about court reforms. And if you look at that blue ribbon panel that President Biden put together that went through boom, 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 every single proposed court reform. They're all in there. It's worth a read, even though President Biden, I think to my slight chagrin, didn't do anything about it. So when you ask what I would do, I would certainly talk seriously about adding seats to the court because it's not unconstitutional, right? It's an easy fix. It's been done before. You just add seats. And I know that you're going to say, and listeners are going to say, but that means, you know, when Trump wins, he's going to add 20 seats and then we have mutually assured destruction. I just don't think mutually assured destruction is a reason to be like lying on the ground, you know, sobbing sadly into your handkerchief. Like if it means that it will be responded to in kind, we are responding, in fact, to Mitch McConnell, who held the court at 8 seats for almost a year. So
and can I just put a little side note on that so people can contextualize this to the point you just made about, well, if Donald Trump wins, you know, let's say Joe Biden were to do this before he left office under the conditions that, I mean, maybe you can talk to us a little bit about how that would happen. And why don't we do that before I make this point? Because I think it's important for folks, since we've raised this now, and if you could share, how does that process evolve or come about to add seats to the Supreme Court, since it's not something that you have to go to 38 states, meaning getting a supermajority of the states to approve constitution?
Yeah, I think you could do it by executive action, which is what FDR wanted to do, right? I think you could do it by legislation. There are certainly bills.
Has it been done both ways in the time that the courts was expanded and contracted before?
Yeah, I think it's been done both ways. And I think that I think, again, we can have a normative conversation about whether it's smart, but I don't think there's any doubt that it is eminently doable.
Right.
And then it's just a question of why are we sort of sitting paralyzed by the notion that it can't be done? And that's a really fascinating historical conversation.
Right.
But it's not that it can't be done. It's that we choose to say
to
it can't be done. And so that's why I want to talk in terms of learned helplessness, because this is an issue on which, you know, when you're starting to talk about age limits or you're talking about term limits, you do run into constitutional problems, right? Because the Constitution says you serve, you know, for life as long as there's good behavior. That you got to pick your way through that one. But adding seats, even though it feels like the nuclear option, it's not hard.
So under the current situation, getting term limits in place would be harder than adding seats, because term limits will require you to address the constitutional allowance of life service. Because the Constitution does not limit, it says you can serve for life. But if the Congress now comes back and says, well, yeah, you can serve for life, but you need to get off the court at 75, that's in my estimation, that's in conflict with what the plain reading of the Constitution allows for. So that would be a hurdle you'd have to overcome.
Correct. And there's legislation already out there. Everything that we're talking about, we've seen, you know, Sheldon Whitehouse.
Various forms to propose.
Yeah, Sheldon Whitehouse, Hank Johnson, Senator Blumenthal. In other words, everything we're talking about, there is something out there already that we can look at. But I think that the solution to the problem you're raising is what you do is you do what essentially they did with Justice Souter and Justice O'Connor, which is they hit a certain age, they retire, they're not forced off the court. They take what's called senior or emeritus status, and then they continue to sit on cases. This is the proposal. And currently what happens to a retired Supreme Court justice is they can sit on a federal appeals court, right? Justice O'Connor used to love sitting on circuit court panels. But essentially you rotate them off the Supreme Court and they're still judges. So they're still serving for life. They're just not on the Supreme Court. And I think that's the principal workaround here.
Yeah.
Is you say you can still sit, but you can't be a Supreme Court justice forever.
I like that. I do like that idea. And it seemingly addresses the concern constitutionally about life service. So that brings me back to the point I wanted to make, was we were talking about increasing the size of the court. And as I was noting, it's easier to do that than to deal directly with the constitutional age limit situation, because the president, by executive order, can say tomorrow, you know, starting October 1, the number of seats available to the Supreme Court will be 13, which means that the president at that time or the next president, should there be a situation where we are now where there's a potential turnover in administrations, would have four seats available to add to the court. Here's what I think people need to appreciate by that point, and a lot of the howling and scowling you will hear from the right and have heard from the right whenever progressives or Democrats raise the question of expanding the court. If you go through and you do an analysis of language around the Project 2025 platforming that they have for the U.S. government, in my conversations with some of those folks in that space, the dirty little secret is that if Donald Trump wins, Donald Trump by executive order, which is why I wanted to approach this way so people could see exactly the glide path that we're about to land this plane on, would plan to add four seats to the Supreme Court. And over the course of that year, or at that time, whenever that's proposed during that term, add four conservative justices, making it a 10-3 conservative court, which largely would basically say for the rest of our lifetime, no matter if a Democrat won, unless there was a catastrophic change in, that affected the members of that court, there would be no rebalancing of that court for probably two generations. And just in case y'all didn't know, generations about 25 years, so you're talking 50 years. That's the dirty little secret here. So folks need to understand when they're talking about going into this election and looking at the things that should matter to them, it ain't just inflation. Okay, it ain't just the price of gasoline. It is what the country's going to look like with a 10-3 dominated conservative court of justices largely in their 40s and early 50s serving on the bench. And that's the truth. And as a conservative, I don't like that, because I think what that does is further polarizes and politicizes the bench, particularly given that the interpretation of the Constitution is an anathema to what Justice Scalia himself stood for. The virus is so twisted and warped the judicial thinking around constitutional norms and principles. We do not, as conservatives on the bench, we no longer hold sacred stare decisis precedent. Tradition. And those are the things that Chief Justice Roberts honored and would articulate over and over again. So I think I just wanted to put that out there so people can appreciate the complete package here of what Dahlia is talking about when we're looking at the shaping of this court going forward. How do these rulings from your perspective, whether Chevron, certainly we know the impact of Dobbs, now the imperial presidency with the immunity ruling, which still, whenever I think about it, I get two things. I am stunned and angered that the court did what it did there. How do you see these rulings collectively or individually impacting the upcoming election, particularly given now we're in a new space? Joe Biden has stepped down from the campaign. Kamala Harris has been elevated to the nomination, which process is unfolding right now as we speak, and likely will be the nominee with very little resistance from Democrats. So we're looking at a Trump-Harris campaign. How do these issues particularly given that one of the members running, one of the individuals running, is a former prosecutor. And there's a whole lot of fun we can do with that. What do you see that the campaign election cycle looks like?
So I think that you've done the very smart thing, which is connect this back to Project 2025, because in 2016, people could say, you know, I don't know, Donald Trump, I don't know what he's about. It's a mystery to me, right? This is a reality show. We can't say that anymore, both because we have the data of what happened between 2016 and 2020, right? We know that he wanted to weaponize the Justice Department to go after his enemies. We know that he wanted to do family separation. We know that he wanted to, you know, pass a law that kept Muslims out of the country, right? Like, none of this is a surprise. And Project 2025 is the mirror of that, right? They're right. Like, not only is none of this a surprise, but wait till we, you know, you see what's coming. And so I don't think anybody gets to go into this election and say, it's a mystery, right? It's a black box. Whatever it is, it's very clear what's coming and what's come before. And that makes it fundamentally a different conversation. Right. We are having a conversation about democracy. And the reason I love that you bring Project 2025 into the conversation is that if you look at the sort of four strains of Project 2025, right, this 900-page document, I know I've just given you the reading assignment of reading the Blue Ribbon, you know, court structural reform report. But after you finish that at the beach, you should read 900 pages of Project 2025. But it basically falls into sort of four baskets. And the baskets are, you know, getting rid of the regulatory state, right? The baskets are super powerful executive branch, right? This idea of the unitary executive and making the president essentially the decider on all things. That's a huge strain here. There's a religious fundamentalist strain, right? Which is reinstantiating the idea of family with God, father, you know, mother who stays at home, and children, right? That's everywhere, all over Project 2025. And I think that it's important to understand every one of the strands has an analog at what the Supreme Court has done this term. Sure. And so it's not just like the wish list of the Heritage Foundation, like if we get into power, we're going to create the strongest executive branch in the world, because the court just did that, right? If we get into power, we're going to upend the entire regulatory state so that, you know, the Department of Education doesn't exist anymore and, you know, the SEC doesn't exist anymore. The court, you know, this year had the opportunity to, you know, completely hobble the way the SEC does things, to, you know, completely, there was an attempt to restructure the way we do tax law. Yeah. That case didn't succeed. But like, I just want to say, like, it's not as though we can't imagine what that would look like in Project 2025, because the court's already put the building blocks in place. And I really want to urge, because I think that the two abortion cases are easy to misread, right? It looks like the court kicks that can down the road in both abortion cases this year, but both abortion cases are coming back. Both the Mifepristone case, right? Because the Project 2025 wants to do away with all abortion medication. Yeah. And the EMTALA decision, the decision about emergency room treatment, that would be rescinded. Under Project 2025, emergency rooms could not save a mother unless she were about to die. If she were about to lose her organs, never be able to have a reproductive function again, no emergency care, no emergency miscarriage care. That would be part of Project 2025. And that case is coming back as soon as next term. So I think we make a mistake of saying, like, oh, well, what the court did wasn't that bad, because in the two abortion cases, they didn't rubber stamp the most crazy abortion regulations. Project 2025 does. Project 2025 does it. So I think that we have to, again, this is the theme of the show, connect up what looks like very disparate stories about Project 2025 and what the president might do, right, and what the court already did this term, because this is the roadmap. And it's not as though we have to wait till next January to see it. This past June, we saw that road brick by brick starting to be put into place.
It is a stunning moment for the country to witness firsthand the court. I would put it this way deliberately. turn on the Constitution and turn on the very idea that the founders had put in place about our system and this concept of checks and balances, where each unit, if you will, the judicial branch, the executive branch, and the legislative branch worked in concert. And seemingly what's happened is the legislative branch is basically, I think they're high on crack. I don't know what they're what they're doing. It's just the executive branch is taking on since 9/11 a lot of extra power that the legislative branch, high on crack, has ceded to them.
Yep.
And the judiciary now seems to be making its move, seems to be busting the move, seemingly reinforcing that executive power grab, right? But at the same time saying that even as an executive, now that we've given you that extra power with the immunity case, where the president can basically at any point in time, by any action he or she takes, declare it to be official, an official act, still the court goes, but you can't check us. You still, right. we, in essence, like Dr. Frankenstein thought of his monster, I created you, right? But eventually what happens is not so much the executive branch or the legislative branch, but the system as a whole turns in on itself. It becomes unmanageable, unruly in its administration of justice, the law, and this idea of the rule of law becomes something the American people trust less and less in. And we've already seen that happening. Our friend Eddie Mistel wrote a great piece in The Nation, and he's talked about it's impossible to overstate the damage done by the Supreme Court in this term. And he makes note of the court has also ruled that insurrectionists who attack the Capitol and obstruct the work of Congress cannot be charged with a crime. But homeless people sleeping on the streets can be sent to jail. And those cases that allow that to happen are the things that touch people where they are. And they come to that point of view, which I just described, where they're like, I can't trust this system because it's not protecting me. It's not representing me. Where do we go from here? What do you, folks, if you're in your car, you just missed the look of the year when I asked that question, because it's one in which it's a combination eye roll and sigh and pain in the gut. What does the court do now? I mean, it's because there's some cases coming down the road. You just mentioned the abortion cases are going to come back in a variety of forms. You already have, I think, Justice Thomas and Alito sort of feeding out to states, particularly red states, find the case to get so we can get to us on contraception so we can repeal Griswold. I mean, what does this look like?
And one other thing, you know, you mentioned at the start, just a week ago, Aileen Cannon tossed the entire Mar-a-Lago, right?
Yes.
Criminal case.
Talk about that. Yes.
Why? Because she is literally taking seriously a Clarence Thomas solo opinion in the immunity case, right? He was writing for nobody but himself. The issue of whether the special counsel was constitutional, neither briefed nor argued, not an issue in the immunity case. And Clarence Thomas literally did a like squirrel, you know, exactly what you just said. He was like, you know, I want fries with this case. And so somebody should come to me with a special counsel argument. And a week later, literally, a week later, she's like, oh, and literally citing a Scalia dissent, you know, from another case, like dissents are not law. But you're exactly right. When you have this notion that everything is unsettled, Michael, everything is up for grabs. We're going to, you know, we are going to be the court that simply says we're open for business. Precedent doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it's a concurrence by one justice. Now right. It's the law. Come to us. And so I think you've described what I think of as the sort of Kyle Rittenhouseification of the legal system, right? Yeah. Which is why I made that face. Because I think it's not an accident. Like I might be able to be more depressed than Elie Mystal, which would be a banner day for me. I think when the court is putting bump stocks back in the hands of every American, right? In a climate in which they are, as I think you and I agree, trying to foment mistrust in every agency, fomenting mistrust in the FBI and the prosecution of the Donald Trump case, which was done by the book, right? Nobody can say that that Mar-a-Lago case was an attempt to assassinate the president at Mar-a-Lago the way it was messaged. If you keep putting out the idea that you can't trust the media, everyone's lying, you can't trust the government, everyone's lying, you can't trust the Department of Education, you can't trust any agency or entity because they're all liars, you are literally doing the Hannah Arendt two-step, right? Mm-hmm. Hannah Arendt says, you don't have to get people to believe lies. You just have to get them to believe nothing, right? As long as they believe no authority, you win. And this is Steve Bannon's flood the zone with shit. If you do that at the same time that you put guns in their hands and you say to them, the election is being stolen, why don't you do your own research? Go to that polling site and make sure that Seamus and Ruby Freeman aren't, you know, pocketing votes. Make sure that people in Arizona aren't flipping votes, right? You are literally creating the conditions for what is just a self-help civil war. And what scares me more than anything is that if you had asked me 6 months ago, even 3 months ago, Michael, I would have said the U.S. Supreme Court says some dumb stuff, but what they do not want is a self-help nation that thinks that the law is broken and they should take it into their own hands, a la Kyle Rittenhouse. I don't know how to read the last few weeks of the term other than this is a very clarion call that agencies are not to be trusted. Police are not to be trusted. The Justice Department is not to be trusted. The election is already rigged. Best of luck, America. I read it that way because I think it was a series of 6-3 decisions that destabilized trust in every single part of government.
And I cannot disagree with any of that. And I think that, in fact, those 6-3 decisions reinforced the political narrative that was already out in front. So now you've got legal justification for it. So when you have individuals stand up and say to the American people that, break it down this way, unless you do things the way we want them done, right? There won't be civil war, right? There won't be. But if you disagree with us, well, it, like the recent comment, you know, about the left, you know, avoiding conflict basically by just doing what we tell them to do, then we'll be fine. And these narratives, I think, are critically important for people to understand how we're getting sucked into a line of bullshit from Steve Bannon, from Steve Miller, from Donald Trump, from J.D. Vance, from these hardline authoritarians. They're telling us, they're showing who their idols are. It's Putin, it's Orban, it's Xi, right? It's not Lincoln or Roosevelt or Eisenhower, right? So I don't understand how people don't see that. But then again, I do, because the fog that's being created around their eyes and the muffles that are being placed on their ears help them avoid seeing and hearing that truth. And what they do see and hear is distorted. And so, to your point, believe nothing, right? Or, you know, just because then I can fill in what I want you to believe when I want you to believe it.
Exactly. And if you foster a sense of mistrust, a sense that, right, this was people are old enough to remember SB8, that Texas vigilante bill, you know, that said that you can take it into your own hands, right? If you think someone is, quote unquote, aiding and abetting an abortion in Texas. And that was the precursor to Dobbs falling. The court already greenlit that before they even overturned Roe. The zeitgeist of that is the zeitgeist you're describing, which is we don't trust the state to enforce our laws. We don't trust the police to enforce our laws. So everybody just saddle up and determine for yourself if that librarian or that, you know, church pastor who's offering somebody counseling about reproductive care is aiding and abetting an abortion. Take it upon yourself to bring a suit against them. And I think that what we forget, and this is so important, you've used the word norms so many times today, that we think that norms are immutable, right? We thought that the norm that, you know, somebody dies on the Supreme Court and we have a you know, hearing and a vote for that person. We thought that was the law. That wasn't the law. That was a norm. And Mitch McConnell broke it, right? And then we had a norm that said once voting has already started in the next presidential election, you don't get to mash somebody onto the Supreme Court. But that norm was also not a law. That was a norm. And I think that what you're describing, and this is such an important split screen moment, is I think that, you know, most of us tend to treat norms as the law.
Yep.
And I think MAGA America treats the law as norms. Everything, nothing is inviolate. Everything is up for grabs.
Right.
And I think we just have to be really clear-eyed and sort of level set that if everything is just up for grabs, we're in big honking trouble.
Yeah.
And if all the things that we thought were immutable and true are going to be negotiated again, we have to be in on those negotiations, including structural court reform, right? Including ethics rules, but including just foundational, foundational conversations about why your vote matters. Even if you think the thing is boring, even if you think it's been manipulated, why we vote, right? Why we have hard conversations with our neighbors, because all of those norms are falling away too. And I think that what we're left with is fear. And I think what we're left in the face of fear, we are left with the idea that the only way we can control our, you know, protect our families and can control our environment is to, you know, saddle up and ride. And I just think that way madness lies. We have to take the temperature down, even if it's unilateral right now, on the idea that everything about government and the media and law are broken. They are not broken, but they are aspirations. And we have to bolster those aspirations now into law.
And that's why she's Dahlia Lithwick. I appreciate that. Dahlia, thank you so much for coming on and spending some time and breaking down some of the complexities around our court system and some of these cases that really have driven both our judicial and political processes over the last term and are now going to play out at the ballot box in November, where voters taking into consideration Dobbs, Chevron, and other cases will decide what the next term of the Supreme Court and future terms of the Supreme Court could look like. And, you know, Joe Biden, you stepped down, bro, but you got a window. You know, you may want to have a little bit of fun with the court. I don't know. Think about it, because I'm telling you, the guy, if he gets in after you, he will. He will reshape this court permanently for at least two generations. That's how hard set the MAGA right is in solidifying not just the authority of the court, but the authority of an imperial presidency that will allow Trump to then in 2028 claim he can run again. Because I didn't have two consecutive terms. And then when he's not when he's done with that one, to run again, because why? So look, I'm a long ball player, Dahlia. I look at things long term. I try to peek around a corner before I get to the end of the block. And I see on the horizon a lot of challenges that you've addressed in this conversation. And I'm hoping, to your point, that people understand exactly what our responsibility and role is as citizens to be a part of fixing and setting straight the direction of the country, not bending backwards and forwards as some would have us do and get lost in translation. So I appreciate you coming on and spending time and helping us walk that walk together.
It is always a treat to be with you, Michael. I always come away with like a new framework that I had missed, and I really appreciate you.
Thank you. We'll definitely be following you and listening to you on Amicus. That's Slate's award-winning bi-weekly podcast about the law and the Supreme Court. And she is amazing in her analysis and learned in what she shares. And so, folks, it is a good chance, an opportunity to sit down with a nice cup of coffee or tea and listen to Dahlia sort of set it straight for you. So thank you for that, Dahlia. Thank you for coming on. And thank all of you for spending some time with us. I always love it when you do, certainly here on my new home at the Bulwark Online. They still like me because I'm still here. So we love that. But I really want you to do me a favor. Before you go, folks, do that download thing. Share this episode of the podcast so folks get a little bit better insight about our judiciary and what's going on with the court. And certainly all the conversations we have here at the Michael Steele Podcast. Until next time, go out there and continue to work on your tan. Mine's coming along very nicely, as you can see. I've been working on it. It's coming up nicely. So until next time, y'all, take care.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest. Life comes at you fast, which is why it's important to find some time to relax. A little you time. Enter Chumba Casino. With no download required, you can jump on anytime, anywhere for the chance to redeem some serious prizes. So treat yourself with Chumba Casino and play over 100 online casino-style games, all for free. Go to ChumbaCasino.com to collect your free welcome bonus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.